Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. On the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, it's March 17, and we have a tradition this show does of celebrating St. Patrick's Day, and we celebrate with Frank Delaney. Frank is terrific. He's a best-selling author of more than 21 books. He's just so prolific. He interviewed more than 3,500 writers for his BBC television program. He hosted his own talk show featuring cultural and literary personalities. He created many shows for the BBC. He has judged literary prizes, the Booker Prize. He was literary director of the Edinburgh Festival. His screenplay for Goodbye, Mr. Chips, I love that movie, was shown on ITV in the UK. And his series, The Celts, was seen in 40 countries and still is in DVD distribution. He's written a number of novels exploring Ireland's history. He knows the history very, very well. Some of the books you may have read: Ireland, Tipperary, Shannon, The Matchmaker of Kenmare, The Last Storyteller, Venetia Kelly's Traveling Show, and many others. He was born in Tipperary, Ireland. He became a broadcaster with RTE Radio and Television and has worked on documentaries and music programs. And in the mid-70s, he joined the Northern Ireland region of the BBC in Belfast and covered the Troubles. He's working right now on another novel. He's doing stage work for the international commemoration that's going to take place next year of the 1916 rebellion, the Easter Rising. He has considered that the most important event in Irish history. And he has passed 1.5 million downloads in his James Joyce Ulysses weekly podcast. So he's a very accomplished cultural figure, Frank. He's living in the States now. And we'll be celebrating with music this St. Patrick's Day and also with some poetry. If you have a favorite Irish story that you would like to tell, we'd love to hear from you. Or if you'd like to tell us who your favorite novelist is or your favorite poet is, how you celebrate St. Patrick's Day, which I'm sure is in a way that is contrary to the way many Americans celebrate St. Patrick's Day. And Frank has some things to say about that as well, that we tend to go out and drink, and that's not what this day is all about. So we're celebrating culturally this hour of the program with Frank Delaney, and we'll be welcoming your phone calls. Here's how you reach our conversation. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can also find us on Twitter, and that address is at K Dunn Program. So we thought we would start. We started with a little bit of music, and we'll be weaving poetry in and out of this conversation. Frank Delaney will be joining us momentarily. And is he with us now? No. So let's start with Seamus Heaney. And he, as you can imagine, Frank is a little busy today because he's the most eloquent man in the world. So we'll be weaving poetry, which is the way when I have my St. Patrick's Day party, which is late this year, I make everybody read poetry. They say they don't like it, but what the heck? Everybody gets into it, and they study their poems, and they put their best voices on, and we always do poetry. Seamus Heaney is one of my favorites. He was and won the Nobel Prize for Literature. He passed away a couple of years ago, but his work is very accessible. So we'll start with a little bit of Seamus Heaney, and then we'll meet Frank, and we'll welcome your phone calls, and we'll celebrate this St. Patrick's Day. Seamus Heaney starts us off with At the Wellhead.
At the Wellhead. Your songs, when you sing them with your two eyes closed, as you always do, are like a local road we've known every turnoff in the past. That midge-veiled, high-hedged side road where you stood looking and listening until a car would come and go and leave you lonelier than you had been to begin with. So sing on, dear shut-eyed one, dear far-voiced veteran. Sing yourself to where the singing comes from, ardent and cut off, like our blind neighbour who played the piano all day in her bedroom. Her notes came out to us like hoisted water ravelling off a bucket at the wellhead, where next thing we'd be listening, hushed and awkward. That blind from birth, sweet-voiced, withdrawn musician was like a silver vein in heavy clay, night water glittering in the light of day, but also just our neighbour, Rosie Keenan. She touched our cheeks. She let us touch her braille in books like books wallpaper patterns came in. Her hands were active, and her eyes were full of open darkness and a watery shine. She knew us by our voices. She'd say she saw whoever or whatever. Being with her was intimate and helpful, like a cure you didn't notice happening. When I read a poem with Keenan's well in it, she said, "I can see the sky at the bottom of it now."
And that's Seamus Heaney, the poet. Well, he won the Nobel Prize for poetry a few years ago. I just love his poems. We're doing poetry and music, and Frank Delaney is joining us this hour. What better way to celebrate St. Patrick's Day? If you have questions about Irish history or music or books or poetry, feel free to join in the conversation this hour. And Frank Delaney is with us now. Happy St. Patrick's Day, Frank.
Thank you. I know I'm going to say what I say every year.
Go ahead.
Is it a full year gone by?
I know, Frank. I was thinking about this. You know that movie, Same Day Next Year?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It's crazy, isn't it?
I know it is.
You know, it's funny, Kathleen, you were playing Seamus Heaney there.
Yeah.
Last week, I think it was last week, the Irish people voted, I think, as their favourite poem of the last century or something like that. That wonderful Heaney poem in which he describes peeling potatoes with his mother. So he really touched,
yes,
the pulse of the country.
Yeah, there's something about the writing. He's very accessible, isn't he?
Very.
It's a beautiful use of words, but we can all understand what he's saying.
You know, and within, the emotional range is very wide, but he has managed to create tremendous elegance with a controlled linguistic range.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that about him.
I do, too. Yeah. Oh, I love having you with us, Frank. It's just a treat.
It's so nice to talk to you again. How have you been?
Well, I've been fine, thank you. I must say, I'm trying to think what's new, but it's a whole year's worth. But you, on the other hand, you're writing another novel, and you're doing something for the stage in celebration of a big anniversary next year, right?
I think so. You're well informed. I was in Chicago some time ago. There's a wonderful couple in Chicago called Cliff and Kathy Carlson. You may know them. They run IBAM every October,
mm-hmm.
in which they run a celebration of all things artistic and Irish over a weekend. I think it's usually the second weekend in October.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fabulous. And they very kindly honor people they feel have made a contribution to Irish awareness. And last year, I was one of the recipients, completely unjustified, but so was the marvelous John Mahoney.
Mm.
You know, from Frasier and so many other things.
Right, right.
And they had a dinner in the Irish Heritage Centre, and it was just completely wonderful. So they are this year. They had the High Kings there in concert. It was sold out. So this October, I think Cliff wants to preview the 1916 centenary, which of course is next year, Easter next year. And that's going to be one of the biggest events, cultural events, for years. There's a five-year, it's very interesting, Kathy, there's a five-year thing starting. I'm sure we'll talk about it. The Easter Rebellion of 1916 happened in April 1916. But it led to the War of Independence, and it led to the Treaty of 1921
mm-hmm.
that created the modern state of Ireland. And the Irish government has more or less decreed that there will be 5 years of commemorations. Because there is so much to say. It is the single, Easter 1916 is the single most important moment in Irish history.
Right.
It was the trigger.
Will you go back for any of the celebrations, Frank?
I don't know. I probably will. I don't know. There are all kinds of plans for things that happen in Dublin. I've always joked that the General Post Office, which the rebels took over on Easter Monday, 1916, the 24th of April, I've always joked that... Do you remember the old Astrodome in Houston, which was the biggest stadium in the world?
Yes.
Well, the General Post Office, the GPO in Dublin, had to have been much bigger than that if you were to judge by all the people who claim to have been in there on Easter Monday, 1916.
Right, right.
So I would like to be... I'm sure it has to be as big again to accommodate all the people who will want to be there on Easter Monday, 2016.
Absolutely. So you call it the most important moment in Irish history. Yeah.
It triggered everything. It started everything. I mean, there had been many revolutions and rebellions before, and they had down through the centuries, going way back. Nothing created... What happened was very, very interesting. And I don't know whether people generally know this or have read it or have come across it, but these were tiny incidents. This was a few hundred men in the center of Dublin, holding out against the British army for 6-7 days. Surrendering, being forced to surrender unconditionally, having been shelled by gunboats and heavy artillery. So they surrendered, and the leaders were taken off to Kilmainham Jail. Now, the various writers, and indeed much of the population of Dublin, condemned this rebellion. Disturbance of the peace. What chance did they have? Some of them didn't even have guns. They had hurling sticks on their shoulders. Hmm. They had handguns, weapons that jammed. What chance did they have?
Right.
And so why disturb the peace? But here's what happened. A bunch of the leaders were executed with summary trials, kangaroo courts, mm-hmm. no defense attorneys allowed, and they were executed. And George Bernard Shaw, who had written scathingly about the rebels, 2 months, the executions ended 2 months after the rising. Shaw changed his mind and wrote a devastating piece condemning the British government, and it changed public opinion overnight.
Mm.
Not only in Ireland, but abroad. And the other thing that's not generally known is, when the leaders were executed, there were vigils of several thousand people on the streets of major American cities, including Chicago and New York. That's how it captured the imagination. So all that's coming up. So we're preparing for that this year, and at the moment I'm preparing for it with various things that I'm writing.
Oh, I'm glad.
So that's work in progress.
You know, Frank, I don't know if we've ever talked about this, but you really need to come to Irish Fest in Milwaukee sometime, too. It's the largest music festival, I think, in the world now, and they do theater. Well, you've got to come here this year.
When does it happen?
Well, it's always either the 16th, 17th, 18th, or the 18th, 19th, 20th, or it's that weekend in August.
In August?
Yes.
Well, this year we have a big event in my hometown of Kenton, Connecticut.
Oh, you do?
On that very weekend, which is difficult. It's an odd time of the year for me. A lot of charity auctions take place, and a lot of stuff happens locally.
Right.
But I would love to go sometime.
Well,
I think, in fact, I'm pretty certain they've invited me a number of times, but the dates have never worked out.
Well, why don't you plan it for 2016? I'll make sure that invitation
would be the right year to go.
Well, it would, and I'll take you out to lunch.
Oh! Definitely I'm going. You say that to all the boys, though.
No, I don't. I'll definitely take you out to lunch. I'm always astounded when I look at all that you've done. Why didn't you just keep doing a talk show for your whole life? I'll bet you were one heck of a talk show host, weren't you?
Well, this is going to surprise you.
Okay.
But my reputation was not for talking, but for listening.
Yes.
It surprises me. But that's what, once the introductions were over, the acme of my success on my own show, and I used to have shows on the BBC, was not to be heard from for several minutes, so that the guests could talk to one another, argue, debate, talk across each other, with my steering it with an occasional, I hope, well-placed question.
Yes.
That, to me, was the pinnacle of success, and I loved doing that. But I do talk. I mean, I talk every week on my own website on this Joyce podcast, which
I know you do,
has just passed 1.5 million.
Frank, congratulations.
500,000 last year.
Isn't that something?
All over the world. Uzbekistan, Moscow, Jerusalem, Seattle, Chicago. All over the world.
Okay, I'm going to do it today. That's how we'll celebrate tonight. I haven't looked at the podcast yet. I mean, I have years ago to see what you were doing.
It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun.
And it keeps, then I don't have to read all through Ulysses because you'll help me get through it, right?
By the time I'm finished, and I've just done the calculation, and if I don't hurry up, it's going to take another 40 years. I've always said it's my hedge against dementia. By the time I'm finished, there will not be, and I mean this to be the case, because it is the case so far for 6.5 chapters, there will not be a single unexplained, unopened out reference in the entire novel.
That's quite a feat. That's
and
a wonderful
that's the objective.
Thing to have
it's
done.
It's great fun to do.
It is fun. And why are people drawn to it? Why? I mean, you're spending a lot of time on this. Why?
Because it is the most perfect rendition of humanity.
Oh.
It's the best understanding of love that you will come across easily.
Hmm.
It is the complete encapsulation of what it is like for ordinary people been glamorized. It is just how we are. This is like the blood going through your veins and through your arteries. It's just perfectly natural and steady, but it's written with all kinds of built-in puzzles. And he did that, Joyce did that in a calculating way, because he wanted a literary reputation. And he knew that the way to get a reputation was to create a book so full of puzzles that scholars would want the plaudits for solving the puzzles. He said, my book is going to keep the professors busy for 100 years. And it has.
He was talking to you, right? He didn't know about you. But
absolutely. The puzzles are great.
Yeah, he was talking to you.
He was talking to me.
Who else do you love to read?
Well, I love the Americans. I'm a big Hemingway fan.
Are you?
Oh, yeah. And you know, one of the things I do if work is slow, starting slow on a day, or if it's really, you know, not a good day, I will take a writer that I love and I will copy type 2 or 3 pages to see can I edit them. You learn a huge amount. You can't edit Hemingway. You can't edit Updike. You can't edit Cheever. You can barely edit O'Hara. You can edit Faulkner. There's stuff, you know, it's just a wonderful exercise. And I keep being drawn back to Hemingway because he did so much using so little. His language was powerful. A much kinder, nicer, deeper, more thoughtful man emerges than the Hemingway who was smeared by his ex-wives, particularly.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, if you read in that period and you encounter him in the works about his friends, the Hemingway that comes across is not the bullying, brash Hemingway we all seem to have been left with. A much more thoughtful, kind man, wonderful with his friends' children, wonderful with his friends, bailing people out all the time. That's the real Hemingway. And that's what you find when you copy edit his work carefully. That's the spirit you reach.
Oh, that's fascinating. You should do a play on that.
Isn't it interesting?
Yes, it is.
But I knew Martha Gellhorn, his wife,
his
second wife. And, you know, you would never, there was no point. Martha Gellhorn would not go into a room unless it had a mirror in it. That's how vain she was. She was a vain and conceited woman. And she didn't have a good word to say for him. Unlike him on her.
Hmm.
And, of course, when I interviewed her, I interviewed her a number of times. And you probe and you probe and you probe. And what do you find in there? Good old-fashioned envy. She couldn't write as well as he could.
Interesting. What are you... You're doing a novel now, too, aren't you, Frank?
I always seem to be working. I seem to be working in all kinds of ways, you know. And it's, you know, I was thinking the other day, it's actually not about getting published at all. It is about the doing of the thing and seeing can you one more time tell the story better. You know, isn't it Hamlet, I think? One of the Shakespeare plays has the saying, tell the truth, but tell it slant.
Hmm.
And Hollywood had the saying, give them what they expect, but not in the way they expect it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the job the whole time. And the novel I'm working on at the moment, which is about the Easter Rising, is, in fact, a real challenge of telling an old story in a fresh way. I'm determined that when people read it, they will have a very, very clear rendition of what happened inside the post office and on that few streets in the center of Dublin in that 6-7 days. But telling that story, which I have known since I was 4 years old, and I've heard all my life, telling it in a fresh way, that's the challenge.
Mm. Frank Delaney is our guest on this St. Patrick's Day. We're going to be welcoming phone calls for him. He's a great conversationalist. He knows his history. He's got a beautiful way of speaking. He's done all kinds of programs, radio programs and television programs, and he's done... news reporting for the BBC in Northern Ireland during the times of the Troubles. He has written a number of novels. I'm sure many of you have read many of them, starting with one that was a huge bestseller in this country, Ireland. He's writing another one. He's doing a stage play, and he's with us every St. Patrick's Day. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
town. You'll be on the Celtic Rail. Are you ready?
Are you ready?
When the madness comes around.
Ben Morrison, Northern Irish performer, and Celtic Ray. And we'll talk to Frank later in the hour. He covered the troubles in Northern Ireland for the BBC for quite some time. I want to discuss that with him. But let's go to phone calls. We have many of them coming in, and Robin is calling in, who grew up in Dublin. Robin, what's your story?
Hi, Robin here. I'm actually in Wisconsin, but I'm from Dublin.
Oh, happy St. Patrick's Day, Robin.
I've called previously on previous years. You know,
yes.
Every year you use the word, when Frank is on, eloquent and eloquence. And Frank's accent is eloquent, and he is the definition of eloquence. And I just need to ask Frank, how do you keep your accent so polished? Because I'm here in the States quite a number of years, and my accent has eroded. But I was unlucky in that I started with a South Dublin accent, which was nothing like a Tipperary accent. But Frank, do you recite something daily to keep your beautiful accent? It's just coming through your blood.
It's a great question, and it has been a question that has plagued me all my adult life. I can tell you this much. My brother lives in County Tipperary, and when my late mother was alive and he called her, she didn't know whether it was him or me calling.
Hmm.
A lot of my accent was it was smoothed out, it was ironed out by 25 years in London. I pick up accents all the time. If I'm in Wales, my voice is up and down. If I'm in Northern Ireland, my voice is up and down. Within a day, I pick up accents all the time. I don't seem to have picked up an American accent, but I sure as hell got a lot of ironing done at the BBC. And they did so consciously. If there was a pronunciation or an inflection or something that didn't work, the producer would tell me. He said, people are not going to understand what you're saying. So quite sort of over the years, a kind of, as I say, ironing is the best word I can use, a kind of ironing and erosion goes on. That said, if one of my sons calls me from Ireland, if I'm talking to somebody in Ireland, my wife, who's American, overhearing, will know I'm talking to somebody in Ireland because my accent changes.
Oh.
So I think it's about being musical.
Yeah, and it is interesting that the different parts of Ireland, people have very different ways of speaking.
Oh, my.
I love the Northern Irish accent. I think it's beautiful. It's lyrical.
Yeah, and if you go over to Derry, you know, they have a sort of much tighter way of talking there.
Right.
And then out in Donegal, it's kind of soft, you know, they're kind of quieter and softer. You know?
Yes.
And it's, you can go around the coast and the accent changes all the time.
Why?
I don't know.
Country.
I think I've been told it has to do with geography. I've been told that people, you know, that accents are created by environment. I don't know enough about it to know whether that is accurate or true. But I do know this, that, for example, in where I come from, which is Midwest Tipperary, which is the mid-southwest of the country, several years ago, the Observer newspaper in England did a story on that particular accent because a whole series, a dozen different broadcasters, came from within a 20-mile radius of one another. People whose names Robin would remember, Val Dunick and Terry Wogan and Andy O'Mahony, people like that, people whose names don't mean anything here in the United States, but meant a huge amount in England, and they were all found to have come within a 20, 25-mile radius of one another. Where I come from, Kathleen, the local Tipperary accent is very slow. It is very deliberate. People don't have to hurry. They talk like this in a very plain and open way. And, you know, you take that, transform it into London and the BBC, and you end up, for better or worse, sounding like me.
You end up with quite a career. Thank you, Robin, very much for your call. Let's go to Jared in Oconomowoc. Hi, Jared.
Happy St. Patrick's Day to everybody.
Thank you,
Frank,
to you.
I really loved your comment on just writing for the purpose. I'm a musician. I have been all my life. I grew up in West Virginia, lots of Gaelic stuff happening in that wonderful part of the country. And I have recorded hundreds and hundreds of albums. Not one of them sold, and I don't really care. I just do it for the fun and just the sheer movement of doing it. I just thought that was a really great comment, and you do have a fabulous accent. I love it. Have a great day, sir.
Thank you so much. There's very little difference, I think, between writing music and writing prose. I think you have to go with the same thing in your head all the time. We don't read with our eyes. We read with our ears, our inner ears. We're listening to good language. And you talked earlier, Catherine, about how Seamus Heaney captivates you.
Yes.
He's on your ear.
Yes, he's on my ear. You're
That's
right.
Where he is. That
You're
cadence,
right.
Those rhythms, they're on your ear. And, you know, your caller's point about writing music, it's exactly the same for me.
Yeah, I like that phrase. He's on your ear.
Yeah.
That's good. Thank you so much for your call, Jared Boyd in Wautoma. Hello, Boyd.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Pardon me. Happy St. Patrick's Day to you and your guest.
Thanks.
I have one question for your guest that I've been grappling with. And then I actually have a few recommendations for American writers that I think you'd be interested in, classic ones. It's about the bagpipe. Is the bagpipe a Irish instrument or a Scottish instrument? My personal opinion, and you'll see my bias, I'm going to say it's a Scottish instrument, so that tells you a little bit about my heritage. But is it both, or does one country have claim to it?
There are people who will tell you that it's a Greek.
Really?
Yeah. And Shakespeare has a mention in, I think it's Henry IV, Part 1, of the woolen pipes. And this is very interesting because it's a play on words. First of all, they did look like a bag covered with wool because they came from sheep and they often cover them with wool. But the other thing is, he could also have been mistaking an Irish word that he heard called illan, the elbow, illa. U-I-L-E is the Irish word for elbow. And the illan pipes are pipes played where the chanter is filled not by the mouth, but by the elbow pressing on the bag to fill the bag with air, pressing on the little bellows to fill the bag with air. So you have the woolen pipes. They're common to so many ancient cultures that it would be futile to claim ancestry for them unless you're Scottish, and preferably in Scotland, where you're safe from the ravages and verbal attacks of Irishmen who say, no, it was Irish.
That Scottish story for Move for Independence absolutely captivated me this year.
Wasn't it extraordinary?
I found myself up at 2 o'clock in the morning watching everybody.
Same here.
Did you really? It was.
I didn't go to bed until it was over.
It was so interesting, wasn't it?
It was very interesting. And if you think about it, is it the only time in the English-speaking world we have seen an actual peaceful bid for independence?
Yes. Yes.
That's what it was.
Isn't
there was
that?
A kind of romantic
mm-hmm.
thing.
Mm-hmm.
There was a kind of depth to it that was romantic in its way. And I was stunned by the whole experience.
I was too, Frank.
Yeah.
I thought, what am I doing? It's 2 in the morning. I'm watching Scotland on TV.
A country you probably will never live in, like me, although I would love to live there. It's a gorgeous country.
I'd love to go there. I haven't been
there. Oh, it's wonderful.
Yet.
It's wonderful.
Yeah. Frank called in and wanted to mention that it's hard to celebrate without also talking about the Catholic-Protestant fighting and killing that has happened over the years. You cover the troubles for the BBC for some time in Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
And it remains, at least it was when I was last there, a pretty segregated country in terms of one town Catholic, one town Protestant, et cetera. Has it improved at all, Frank?
It has improved. It's improved in all kinds of ways, and there are all kinds of, you know, unities that now operate, both at an official level and at personal and school level. The really interesting developments will happen there when all the schools eventually become integrated
mm-hmm.
and where there is no difference. The troubles in Northern Ireland were really pushed by the unionist overlords after the country was partitioned in the 1920s. They understood that to get control or to stop bloody revolution, to stop the working classes rising against the owner classes, was to keep the working classes at each other's throats. One of the biggest cultural surprises of my life, Kathleen, was to discover when I started working for the BBC in Northern Ireland, and I was working from the south, was to discover that the Protestant working classes in Northern Ireland were just as deprived and impoverished as the Catholic working classes. And the lady in Paisley, that famous rabble-rousing MP
yes.
who died recently, He told me that when he was elected to the constituency of South Down, one of the powerful constituencies in Northern Ireland, that, you know, half of the people coming to him looking for electricity and running water in their houses were Catholic and half were Protestant. Hmm. So there was that sort of divide and rule thing going on all the time, and it kept them at each other's throats. Now, then, of course, it went on. It became a battle for civil rights, and it became, as we know, it became the Troubles that started 69, 1970, and it became, in the eyes of some, a Republican war. And certainly when I was covering it, it might as well have been a war zone, and was indeed a war zone, because there was at least one army in there, the British Army, and a guerrilla army of the Provisional IRA. A lot of it is dying down. It will still rumble on. Time and other things will erode it completely, not least outbreeding when it eventually happens and the Catholic population is larger than the Protestant population. But that does not mean that the Catholics will of necessity vote to be part of the Republic of Ireland rather than the United Kingdom. Hmm. So yeah. It's one of those world problems that will go on forever.
Yeah, fascinating. We're welcoming phone calls for Frank Delaney. We're celebrating St. Patrick's Day as we do with him each year, and we're just delighted to be able to do this. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Once again this year, and I know this must be very troublesome to you because we've talked about this before, the way this day is celebrated in America with pictures in every newspaper of people wearing all green going to bars at 6 o'clock in the morning just makes me so upset, Frank.
Oh, yeah. Somebody on television the other night called it the yuck of the Irish. It's less obvious, it seems to me, in New York this year. A few years ago, you may remember this, Kathleen, I attacked it on NPR.
I know you did.
I wrote a rap, and the rap kind of went half viral, and there was a tremendous response to it, because people being drunk on St. Patrick's Day are being racist. Call it what it is. They're doing a racial profiling of the Irish on the assumption that the Irish are always and everywhere drunk.
Right.
And most of the people who get drunk on St. Patrick's Day here are not Irish and never have been and never will be. And when I see them in the street and they stop me, it's just happened to me today, I said to them, you're not Irish, I am. You're racist, I'm not.
Ooh, Frank.
And I walk on. And that's, you know, that's the little bit I can do.
why is it celebrated that way in this country? I just don't get it.
Well, we started here with a bad press because, you know, you always speak badly of those you treat badly. And when the Irish came over to the United States first, we were the first slaves here in the late 1500s. We were on the Hudson, all the patroons, if you look at the records of the farms. We were working in the cotton docks on the South Mississippi. And we were the first slaves, and we arrived here with a bad press because we were thrown out of our own country. And therefore, we were always labeled as drunk and deformed and incapable and unreliable. And that ticket stuck to us right up into the middle and the late 20th century. It's not there anymore because we've grown up and we've shown them that we're not incompetent and incapable. And most of the adult population in Ireland doesn't drink anyway.
Yeah.
And that message is slowly getting across.
Jess is calling in from Milwaukee. Hey, Jess, happy St. Patrick's Day.
Hi, ditto, thank you. And I am partly Irish. My grandfather is Irish on my mother's side. So, but my question is, how true is it, a story I heard concerning the stereotypical corned beef and cabbage, that it was actually pork and cabbage for the Irish, but when they came over to this country, pork prices were very high, and the Jews in the northeast section of the country turned them on to corned beef as a cheaper meat.
I would have strong doubts about that story, because in Ireland it has always been, you know, either. It was, when I was growing up, it was corned beef and cabbage, or it was ham and cabbage. It's sort of the national dish in Ireland, if there is such a thing, in the countryside, would be bacon and cabbage. And every house, from the lowest economic standards to the highest, knows that dish. So therefore, there was an establishment in existence. But I had corned beef and cabbage as much as a child in my mother's house, in my father's house, as I ever had bacon and cabbage. So the Irish certainly were habituated to it by the time I was born in the 1940s. Now, it could be true, but, you know, the story has just a slight tinge of anti-Semitism in it, and I wonder about it.
What will you have today?
Today?
Yes.
I will not observe St. Patrick's Day fully as I want to in the United States until I see the last drunk off the streets of New York.
All right, Frank.
I am wearing a green shirt, though.
Which one is coming first, the ending of the podcast of Ulysses or your mission to get...
If there's much about it this year, I'm going to have another crack at them next year.
All right,
good. I mean, it was disgusting here in New York when I came here first 12 years ago. By this hour of the day now, I would have been stepping over bodies in pub doorways.
Oh.
It was just disgusting.
That is disgusting.
But there was no trace of it. I've been out in the streets, lower Manhattan originally, but there's no trace of it today where there used to be a lot of it.
Yeah.
So maybe better.
We have to pause for just a second. And coming back, I want you to intro this for us. Actually, let's do it now. You talk about this song in a note that you sent to us with Sinead O'Connor, and this is with the Chieftains.
Yes.
And I think you really love this song. Set it up for us.
This is a song called The Foggy Dew, and it is written by the man who wrote the previous Irish national anthem, the soldier's song, Padraig Connolly. And it's a very good graphic ballad. It's a picture song. It describes what happened in Easter week in four succinct verses. It's beautifully sung by Sinead O'Connor and gorgeously arranged and backed by the Chieftains, by Paddy Maloney.
We'll hear some of it. We've asked Frank to read some poetry as well. We're celebrating St. Patrick's Day on the Ideas Network. Here's part of The Foggy Dew. Delaney joins us this St. Patrick's Day, and we're celebrating St. Patrick's Day with Frank, and we go next to, Jean is next in Milwaukee. Hi, Jean.
Hi, Kathleen. I'm so glad to get to talk to you and Frank today. Happy Paddy's Day.
Thanks, you too.
So my husband's from Dublin, came over in the wave in 94, and he's often lamented on the mascot of Notre Dame being the Fighting Irish, and I thought of that when Frank was talking about the origins of the stereotypes. But so many things I have to think of, but thank you for that version of the Foggy Dew. There's so many good versions, but that, you really catch the poetry of it and the essence of it. I did catch a good version by the Screaming Orphans at Irish Fest, so that's it from here. Thanks very much.
Thanks. Don't you think Frank ought to be at Irish Fest, Jean?
Oh, for sure, for sure. Reading some poetry would be fabulous.
I know. We got to get him here. We will. 2016 is the year. Yeah, there is something. Well, it's also the Chieftains, too. I love the Chieftains, but that is just you can feel that. It sort of gives you shivers, doesn't it?
Oh, it's wonderful. It's a marvelous piece. And she's got her interpretation of it is, I think, one of the best I've ever known. The Dubliners had a great version. The late Luke Kelly, who had, you know, a voice made of brass. He was wonderful.
Mm.
Imagine brass being tuned to the highest pitch. He had a great version as well. But I think Sinead O'Connor is my favorite version. It's a song, remember, I've known since I was about 6 years old.
Mm. Yeah. Are you offended by the Fighting Irish, Notre Dame, by some of the...
No, I'm not. I understand its culture. I understand its genesis, and also the Fighting Irish thing in America is very, very interesting. The Fighting 69th, for example, the Civil War, Connecticut, the state of Connecticut where I live, it raised, I think, three regiments of Irish in the Civil War,
and the Irish Brigade from Wisconsin too, very
absolutely
famous.
And yeah. So there is an element. I think the Fighting Irish here doesn't mean what it means in London, which where it means the brawling Irish. I think the fighting Irish here has a tinge of the military to it, and that has transferred or been projected onto Notre Dame.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Cindy in Fox Cities. Hi, Cindy.
Aaron, go bra, Frank. Anyway, I just got done reading a book called The Orphan Train, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with that or not.
No.
About the immigrants that would come over from Ireland and many other countries, and if the family would fall on hard times or the mother or father died, the children would be boarded on trains and sent west.
Yes, I've heard about it.
Okay, well, I was just wondering if you were familiar with it, and if you know if you have any of your descendants that might have fallen on those hard times and been shipped across God knows where parts of the country, and apparently they didn't have very great lives when they got where they were going. So,
but one of the things that has been happening in the last 10, 15, 20 years, and for which I am, you know, hugely grateful, is the history of how we treated our children, especially our institutionalized children, is now not slowly anymore, coming out fast.
Yes.
The movie Philomena, for example, was a perfect example of that. And I had very, very early on, back in the 1970s, was it? I'm trying to think. Yes, I think it was. I saw this trickle happening and eventually becoming a flood. There was a movie called the Magdalene Sisters, and then Philomena. Along the way, we are beginning to shed the idea that we were a perfect Christian people. We weren't. We were extremely flawed, and in some ways we were worse than many others, because what we were brilliant at since the days of the military of the British in Ireland, we were brilliant at the cover-up. And that's what you've seen. A lot of the people, I knew boys in London who had been part of the equivalent there of an orphan trade, and they were, you know, scarred forever. Children who had been adopted and fostered and passed from pillar to post because of parents died or something like that. The more these stories come out, the more I will like it, because it will cut through a huge amount of historical hypocrisy from which we've all suffered as a nation for far too long.
Hmm. Let's talk just a moment about immigration. We spent the first hour talking about undocumented Irish in the United States, which was fascinating. But there are something like 33.7 million people in America who claim Irish descent. That's a huge number of people, Frank. How did that happen?
It's one of the biggest self-identifying blocks. I think it's the second biggest. German is the biggest ethnic block. I think Irish is second, but the German ethnic block doesn't self-identify as much as the Irish does. The Irish have been coming here to the New World since King James exported 550,000 Irish men, women, and children to the West Indies and to the United States as basically slaves in the late 1500s. Every century since has had Irish coming here, plus the huge hemorrhages, as President Kennedy called them, of the potato famine immigrants, and before and after then. And a base was established, and we went everywhere. If you look at the history, for example, of the state of Texas, at the founding of the state of Texas, it's all Irish names.
Really?
People like Sam Houston, all over the place. And every state you go to in the United States, somebody told me the other day that pro rata, per head of population, proportionally speaking, the biggest St. Patrick's Day parade in North America is in Butte, Montana.
Oh, my goodness. Are you
serious? We did get everywhere. And everywhere I go, I meet Irish people. The prevalence of Irish names here has never ceased to astonish me. So we had a deep penetration because we came from nothing and we worked our way in, and obviously worked.
I think it was 2 years ago, we talked to you about the slaves in the West Indies, and you said you were doing work on that.
I've been working on it steadily and quietly.
Have you? And will you have a book or something?
What I now know is that it's a completely true story.
Really?
Yeah, it's not well documented. I know I'm getting more and more knowledge of where documents are, but I now know that it's a completely true story.
Mm.
And there are some fascinating sidelights to it. The great architect Olmsted, for example, he did a trip to the South, to the American South, in the 1870s, I think. And he describes seeing the Irish laborers on the cotton docks of the Mississippi, speaking to ships coming in from Ireland in Gaelic to the men on board the ships, who also spoke Gaelic, and observing that the Irish laborer on the Mississippi was inferior to the African-American.
Hmm. Fascinating. Matthew on email wants to know this. We've all heard of leprechauns. What can you tell us of Irish myths? Well, you've written more than a few books about Irish myths, so it would take a long time. But give us a story, Frank. Give us
a
myth.
Well, there's an interesting... I get his question, and it's a more interesting question than the mythology suggests. Every culture in the world, almost, or every culture that has been well-tracked by the mythological researchers and the sociological researchers, and I think Margaret Mead did something on this, every culture has, deep within the throes of addiction, a little green figure.
Huh.
The Mexicans have one. Several of the countries in South America have one. The Irish have the leprechaun. As though there is something in the brain that is triggered by alcohol to produce an image like that. But certainly that is where it comes. And I've spoken to people who took a lot of mescaline, and they say, yes, absolutely, there comes a moment when you do see a little green man.
Oh, Frank, you never know what you're going to answer when you ask
So the leprechaun thing is not without foundation.
Huh.
That said, did you see by any chance Darby O'Gill and the Little People on television the other night?
I didn't, no.
Yeah, probably the worst movie ever made. But it did have the young Sean Connery.
Oh, it did.
It did.
Yeah, great. We have about a minute. Can you give us a minute poem?
I will.
I'm
going to do this from memory.
Oh.
Because it's Patrick Kavanagh's epic, and it's a terrific poem. It's about great things relating to small things. I have lived in important places, times when great events were decided, who owned that half a rood of rock and no man's land surrounded by our pitchforked armed claims. I heard the Duffys shouting, damn your soul, and old McCabe stripped to the waist, seen, stepped the plot, defying Blue Castile. Here's the march along these iron stones. That was the year of the Munich bother. Which was more important? I inclined to lose my faith in Ballyrush and Gortin, till Homer's ghosts came whispering to my mind. He said, I made the Iliad from such a local row. Gods make their own importance.
Thank you, Frank. Come to Milwaukee 2016.
Buy me lunch and I'll be there.
All right, you're on. It's a deal. Happy St. Patrick's Day. Thanks again.
And you, Kathleen. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Frank Delaney, our guest. He's written many, many books. If you haven't read them, start with Ireland. I'm sure you'll love it so much. And he's just written prolifically. His podcast, a line-by-line examination of James Joyce, Ulysses. If you go to Frank Delaney on the internet, you'll find a whole page of all that he's done, and you can get involved in that. He'll help you read Ulysses. What more can you ask for on this St. Patrick's Day? Thanks so much for listening. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this program, and thanks to KP as well for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Have a lovely St. Patrick's Day evening with poetry, good meal, some music, the best of Ireland.